This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, the 26th of July, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast. In the wake of Norway's massacre, we look at the extreme right in the country and across Europe. The EU begins a partnership with Liberia. They'll barcode trees in an effort to stop illegal logging and protect the environment. And activists in Los Angeles call for a federal investigation into radical cuts to bus services, which they say are a civil rights violation. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. NATO Colonel Chris Toner apologized today to the families of six civilians killed during military action in Afghanistan just over a week ago. NATO initially denied the dead were civilians, but recanted after a local protest and strike in Khost. Yesterday, NATO officials admitted injuring five children in a helicopter strike in Helmand on Saturday. The kids were taken to a military hospital for treatment. And according to Press TV, the governor of Kunar said today that another three civilians were killed by the international forces. NATO has not commented on the Kunar claim. Yet another reporter in Mexico is dead today. Shannon Young reports.
For the second time in as many months, a journalist working for the Notiver newspaper in Veracruz has been brutally murdered. Crime reporter Yolanda Ordaz de la Cruz went missing on Sunday. Her body was reportedly dumped behind the office of another local newspaper in the troubled Gulf Coast state. Ordaz de la Cruz had been following up on the murder of her longtime colleague, Notiver columnist and crime editor Miguel Angel Lopez, who was shot dead with his wife and a son inside their home last month. The murdered son, Misael Lopez, had recently begun taking photos for the paper, where his older brother also works. Crime reporters working for local newspapers are among the most targeted journalists in Mexico, a country that has for years ranked as the hemisphere's deadliest for press workers. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
Amnesty International has accused Nigerian security forces of committing human rights violations in their fight against the Boko Haram. Sam Olokoya reports from Lagos.
Amnesty International says the latest incident followed a bomb blast in a market over the weekend in which three soldiers were injured. Security forces responded with random gunfire. At least 23 people died. They then set fire to the market. The bomb is believed to have been set off by the Boko Haram, an armed Islamist group. The militant group wants Islamic law imposed in the region. Amnesty International says that in their fight against the Boko Haram, the Nigerian Joint Military Task Force regularly commits human rights violations, including unlawful arrests, extrajudicial killings, and rapes. The security agents say their actions are inevitable because some people in the city have been collaborating with the Islamists. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
An energy company has ordered enough fuel to keep an aging nuclear reactor in Vermont online for another year and a half, despite state laws requiring it to close in March. Carl Ettenier reports.
Entergy Nuclear has sued the state of Vermont in federal court. The company says federal regulations allowing the plant to operate for another 20 years overrule any state actions that could close the 39-year-old reactor next spring. Entergy's chief nuclear officer told the court he wanted the assurance of a preliminary injunction before ordering $65 million worth of new fuel, enough to last 18 months. Last week, the judge denied the preliminary injunction. Nonetheless, the company announced Monday that it had ordered the new fuel. Entergy CEO Wayne Leonard says they've done so because they believe their case is strong. Conservation Law Foundation attorney Sandra Levine is helping the state of Vermont defend its power to shut down a nuclear plant.
It's yet another example of Entergy not really being very forthcoming or very honest or trustworthy, and that's disappointing.
The full trial in the lawsuit is scheduled for September. Carl Ettenier, FSRN, Montpelier.
A string of bias attacks in the Portland area has led to the formation of a new anti-hate group in the city. Just hours after they held their first major demonstration, another gay man was assaulted. FSRN's Jess Burns has the story.
The Oregon State Gay Pride Organization formed after four separate attacks against LGBT men and women in the city and surrounding suburbs. The first happened in May. All four are being investigated as bias crimes. Police have only made arrests in one of the incidents, saying even though the attacks happened in public places, witnesses have been slow to come forward. The newly founded Gay Pride group organized the We Are Not Afraid march. On Saturday, more than 300 LGBT people and their allies marched in downtown Portland. But just a few hours after the march ended, another member of the LGBT community, Andrew Dempsey Gluth, was physically assaulted after being pelted with anti-gay slurs. This time, the police were able to arrest the suspect and charge him with assault and intimidation. March organizers say they plan to hold additional events in the near future. Jess Burns, FSRN, Eugene.
For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. The Norwegian police are continuing their investigation into the weekend's mass murder by Anders Behring Breivik. Breivik is facing terrorism-related charges for the two attacks, a bomb explosion in the capital Oslo and a shooting spree on a nearby island. 76 people are confirmed dead. Police spokesperson Johan Fredriksen.
We have also an advanced search going on in the fjord, and we will do everything possible to find out if there is any more people missing.
Sound courtesy of the BBC. Yesterday, more than 100,000 people took part in an anti-violence rally on the streets of Oslo, many holding flowers in memory of the people killed. The attack has raised serious questions about the extreme right in Norway and across Europe. For more, we go to Jonathan Birdwell, violence and extremism researcher for the UK branch of the independent think tank Demos. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you very much for having me.
When he was arrested, Breivik said he wanted to awaken his countrymen. What message do you think he was trying to send?
I think he was trying to send a message to a variety of people who I think you would describe on the kind of far right, to say a lot of people on the right have been talking about the threat of Islam as a culture, as a political ideology to European culture, and I think the message he was trying to send to these individuals on the far right was that the time was beyond talking and there was a need to act.
What sorts of extremist political groups exist in Norway that might share Breivik's political philosophy?
Well, there is the Progress Party, the Norwegian Progress Party, which is a far-right party in Norway, in which Breivik was a member of until he became disillusioned with the kind of slow pace of democratic politics. There is a Norwegian Defence League that has been modeled after the English Defence League in the UK, which is a far-right street-based type movement. I imagine there are also some fragmented, very small neo-Nazi type groups, because this seems to be common in throughout Scandinavia, in Denmark and Sweden. Now, these neo-Nazi groups actually have more of a following in Sweden than they do the other groups. But in general, these are often very small groups of at most 15 to 20 individuals.
So where does Breivik fit in exactly in this constellation of far-right groups?
Well, he's obviously on the fringe in the sense that he, you know, he's a violent individual, he's a terrorist. No, I don't think the formal political parties, even though if they share some of his views, they wouldn't advocate his methods. However, I think he's actually very interesting and different than a lot of the groups that we've seen so far, and mainly that's in his kind of view that he's a Christian martyr and that he is a member of this Knights Templar, which is, you know, obviously a medieval organization related to the Crusades. I had never heard of it in the current context. He posed the question to himself in the manifesto, who would he most like to meet? And he said the Pope. I think a lot of people in the formal political parties are a bit upset. They wish that they could label him as a Nazi and dismiss him as a neo-Nazi. But he goes to great lengths in his manifesto to distinguish himself from Nazis, from race-based type far-right groups, and emphasizes cultural conservatism. And this is exactly the same message that a lot of the formal political parties would advocate. So in terms of his ideology, I think he's closer to the formal political parties, actually, but in his methods, he is not at all.
What impact do you expect this crime to have on the political debate about multiculturalism in Europe and the extreme right?
Yeah, that this, I think, is probably the most interesting question, because you see formal political parties actually on the right scrambling to disassociate themselves with him. And actually, also interestingly, in the UK, you cannot, you know, I've done a lot of media, and what I'm hearing from media is that they can't get any politicians to come out and make any kind of comment about this. And, you know, I think mainstream politicians, as we've seen the rise of far-right political parties, they've kind of exerted a gravitational pull on the center, and we've seen David Cameron, Angela Merkel come out and pronounce that multiculturalism is dead. So I think mainstream politicians actually have a quite tricky job to do in the coming months and years to talk about these issues, which clearly concern a lot of people, but to do so in a way that's measured and which doesn't fan the flames of far-right political parties and far-right fringe groups.
The sorts of crimes that are usually associated with the extreme right are hate crimes, often against immigrants and minorities. How frequent are violent hate crimes by the extreme right in Norway and across Europe, and who tend to be the targets these days?
Yeah, no, that's the interesting thing. People ask, you know, to what extent the size of the violent far-right fringe. Now, I mean, you don't. I think if you're talking about terrorist violence, I mean, the prevailing wisdom was that it was very small. But nonetheless, you still had a culture of violence within neo-Nazi and other type fringe movements on the far right. But it was kind of more of around these kind of hate crimes or football hooliganism. And in Denmark, a lot of it was between far-right groups attacking far-left groups, left-wing activists, these kind of anti-fascist groups that have arisen, a lot of almost war between these different groups. But at the same time, you know, you're seeing them target increasingly Muslims and mosques. So, you know, there's certainly a culture of violence in the fringe groups, and it's mainly directed at Muslims and Islam.
Jonathan Birdwell, researcher on violence and extremism for Demos in the UK. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Each year, billions of dollars of lumber is illegally harvested from the world's forests, affecting the environment, the planet's ability to deal with climate change, and government revenue. Elected officials and NGOs are attempting to combat illegal logging, including through a new partnership between the EU, Indonesia, and some African countries. Today, we're going to take a look at a program which is barcoding trees in Liberia, so timber can be traced back to its source. FSRN's Cinema Nippard has more.
Under former Liberian President Charles Taylor, Liberia's forests were plundered to fund the regime during the 14-year civil war. Logging companies were essentially given free rein to do what they liked. Communities were terrorized, while logging companies ignored social and environmental regulations and did not pay taxes, to the tune of $64 million. But following the war's end, Liberia is getting back on its feet, working to eliminate corruption and protect its forests and the rich biodiversity within them. In an effort to reduce illegal logging, the European Union has developed timber regulations and signed a voluntary partnership agreement with Liberia. Jürgen Meyer, director of the German NGO Forum on Environment and Development, says it's a step in the right direction.
The history of multilateral forest governance is very poor. There was in Rio 92 an attempt to get a forest convention. It failed. Numerous other multilateral processes failed because it has always been impossible to get a consensus on international level. So I think the bilateral negotiations between the EU and those countries that say, yes, we want to improve our forest governance, are very, very important because they set a precedent.
Once ratified, the Voluntary Partnership Agreement will be a legally binding agreement, requiring vigilance and compliance from both Europe and Liberia to ensure that timber is sourced legally. Silas Siakor from the Liberian NGO Sustainable Development Institute.
It takes into account the responsibility of the consumer, in this case Europe, for example. It also transfers some of the responsibilities for the corruption on our end, on the corporations in Europe that engage with our governments. So corruption in any situation requires, in financial terms, somebody to pay a bribe, for example, in order for somebody to take a bribe. And in that situation, the two persons have got to share equal responsibility.
Under the agreement, every single tree will be barcoded.
It will be tracked from stump in the forest through the processing at the port of export in Liberia and at the port of entry in Europe. So if a big construction company wanted to bring in wood from Liberia, they could actually ask the company to give them the data. They would be able to trace the origin of that timber right back to the stump, to the community where the timber came from. So literally there will be no excuse to say we don't know where the timber is coming from.
Siakor says that the most important aspect of the Voluntary Partnership Agreement is that it sets a definition of legality.
The key question is, what is legal timber? What will constitute legal timber? From the point of view of Liberian laws, from the point of view of Liberian stakeholders. So what we have done is to develop a couple of principles that would define legality, and for each of those principles also establish very clear criteria that will be checked to ensure that there has been compliance.
This means clear and transparent consultation and negotiation between Liberian communities, logging companies, and the government. But Thomas Fritz from the German environment and development NGO called Blue 21 says it will be difficult to ensure that the certification standards are met.
What we know from our experience with the certification schemes is that maybe once or twice a year there will be an auditor who makes a visit on these plantations, and normally these auditors, they only want to see the paperwork, whether the paperwork is in order, and then they make one or two interviews, one interview with the management, a second interview with one person responsible for the running of the plantation, and maybe they will also make an interview with one plantation worker. That's it.
Despite more stringent regulations under the new Liberian government, Siakor from the Liberian NGO Sustainable Development Institute says that the rules have already been broken.
When we did an assessment of all the new contracts that have been allocated in 2008-2009, when we did this assessment in 2010, we found that all the timber concessions that had been allocated in violations of different provisions in the law. So again, we hold the government responsible.
Siakor says that these violations have direct financial ramifications for Liberia.
Right now, as we speak, about 13 to 40 million US dollars is now in arrears from operations that started in 2008 and 2009. So if you look at the rate at which the arrears are growing, that again is a worry for me, because in another 10 years, we could be talking about similar losses as we saw in the past, $64 million, which have gone uncollected. Up to now, none of the companies have paid.
The Voluntary Partnership Agreement was announced in May and will be ratified by the European Parliament and the Liberian Parliament sometime before 2012. The EU also has similar agreements with Ghana, Cameroon, the Republic of Congo, and Indonesia. Cinnamon Nipard, FSRN, Berlin.
With the deadline to increase the debt ceiling just a week away, President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner both took to the airwaves to discuss the currently gridlocked debate. After the president asked Americans to contact their representatives and demand a reasonable compromise, the Capitol's telephone circuits were overwhelmed with calls, and several congressional websites crashed. The two main competing proposals both focus on massive spending cuts tied to raising the debt ceiling. But a progressive lawmaker sees another path. Alice Olstein reports from Capitol Hill.
In his primetime television address, the president described the plan he was crafting with Speaker Boehner before the negotiations fell apart, a plan that included both deep cuts in spending and raising additional revenue from ending tax breaks for the wealthy and corporations.
The only reason this balanced approach isn't on its way to becoming law right now is because a significant number of Republicans in Congress are insisting on a different approach, a cuts-only approach. An approach that doesn't ask the wealthiest Americans or biggest corporations to contribute anything at all.
Tuesday morning, Speaker Boehner defended his Budget Control Act from the president's critiques.
There's more cuts in spending than you have an increase in the debt limit. It has real caps and a real process for cutting spending before the end of this year. And it provides for, I think, the best effort to get a balanced budget amendment enacted into the Constitution. It's reasonable, it's responsible, it can pass the House, and it can pass the Senate.
Boehner's plan would raise the debt ceiling in two stages, a $1 trillion hike this year and another $1.8 trillion a year later, but only if enough spending has been cut by that time. CNN has cited unnamed sources who claim this short-term solution puts the U.S. at risk of a credit downgrade from rating agency Standard & Poor's. Moody's declined to comment on Boehner's plan, but said the uncertainty has put the U.S. on review for a possible downgrade from its treasured AAA rating. On Monday evening, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid introduced a competing plan, which also relies entirely on spending cuts. But the difference lies in what gets cut and when. Reid's plan would reduce deficits by about $2.7 trillion over 10 years, and nearly a trillion of those savings would come from defense spending cuts.
This proposal satisfies Democrats' core principles by protecting Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and providing a long-term extension of the debt ceiling that the markets are looking for. The bill also meets Republicans' demands, two major demands. It contains no revenues, and the amount of the cuts meets the amount of the debt ceiling increases. They wanted a one-for-one, that's what we've given them.
But through all this, there's a significant question which is being missed, and that is this trip necessary? Does this really have to happen? Why is it that we have a debt-based economic system? What are the implications for the people of this country and for the world?
Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich is not a fan of either the Boehner or the Reid plan and wants to use this crisis to radically reevaluate the way our economy functions. This week, he plans to reintroduce the National Emergency Employment Defense, or NEED Act. The bill would strip the Federal Reserve of the power to create and regulate money and put it back in the hands of Congress and the Treasury Department. It would also prioritize job creation and a full employment economy over profit.
Implementing this legislation enables Congress to pay off the national debt as it comes due and provides the funding to rebuild America's crumbling infrastructure, creating millions of good jobs in the process.
Both the Boehner and the Reid plans would create a new bipartisan congressional committee that would identify and suggest budget cuts. Proposals from the committee, referred to by some as the Super Congress, would be guaranteed up or down votes in the full Congress, with no amendments. Some lawmakers, such as Massachusetts Democrat Barney Frank, have warned that this fast-track model is designed to push through unpopular cuts to social programs. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
This summer, the Metropolitan Transport Authority in Los Angeles implemented one of the largest cuts to buses ever, eliminating more than 300,000 hours of services. Businesses, low-income, and Latino transit riders in East LA have been particularly hard hit. Activists are calling the bus agency's move a civil rights violation and have asked federal officials to investigate the matter. Lailani Albano has more on the story.
79-year-old jeweler Maria Elena Castañeda is used to being on her feet, but now that her bus line has been cut, she must carry a cane to walk the three long city blocks from the bus stop to her workplace. That has made her commute difficult and cumbersome.
I've never had trouble walking until now.
Castañeda of East Los Angeles is among the more than 500,000 transit riders in the city who are affected by the June 26 service cuts. In the latest round of cuts, about 28 bus lines have been eliminated or truncated. The Bus Riders Union, a civil rights group, says this translates into a loss of more than 300,000 bus service hours.
Do you think that they should be cutting bus service?
I do not think they should, because it's affecting a lot of children and senior citizens and students.
The union is demanding that bus services be restored. Sun Young Yang, an organizer with the union, says the cuts have taken a heavy toll on Latino and African-American transit riders in South, Southeast, and East LA, where most of the service eliminations took place.
Their mobility has been severely impacted.
In all, 940,000 hours of bus service has been cut within the last 4 years. Yang says the cuts reverse most of the 1.2 million hours that bus riders have gained over the last decade since the LA Bus Agency was forced to abide by a federal consent decree mandating that they improve service for minorities.
They've already eliminated over 90% of many of the federally mandated civil rights improvements that MTA had to make.
While bus services are being cut, rail construction has multiplied. Next year, LA Metropolitan Transportation Authority will begin massive construction of an unprecedented 3 rail lines. Yang says building more rail while cutting bus service is unfair since most MTA transit riders use the bus.
If you can't even protect the very users of your system, the bus riders, from continuing to use the system, then there's no way you can expand on all these projects and think that you're going to have a viable transportation system.
Castaneda greets passersby as she sweeps the entranceway of her workplace, Garcia's Jewelers, which is located on First Street in East LA.
Hola, hola, ¿cómo estamos?
For decades, First Street was bustling with local residents who frequented banks, retail shops, and furniture stores that lined the thoroughfare. But today, the corridor has only a fraction of the foot traffic it used to have after bus line 30 was altered and line 31 was eliminated more than a year ago. The Gold Line, a new rail line that parallels First Street, was supposed to replace the need for bus service, but Yang says that hasn't happened.
First Street was a very vibrant local neighborhood, and with the elimination of the bus line 30, many of the elders and disabled folks that used to take that line to traverse throughout First Street have been impacted because they can't walk far and the Gold Line does not serve their needs.
Without good bus service, few people make it out to First Street.
Our business is down, I would say about at least 30%, yeah, at least that.
That was jewelry shop owner Edward Garcia. Other First Street business owners say that figure is closer to 40 to 60% at their stores. In addition to hurting businesses, the bus cuts pose serious obstacles for people with disabilities and the elderly. Rosa Amescua, who works at Ramirez First Street Pharmacy, says that senior citizens are unable to pick up their medication. That one concern has motivated many elderly customers to relocate.
Most of them, they're moving to another areas, which is a big impact for our business.
Conan Chung is LA Metro's Deputy Executive Officer of Service Planning and Scheduling. He says the service reductions are designed to streamline services.
Most of the service changes are to make sure that we better coordinate our services between our bus and rail programs and to reduce duplication with the municipal operators.
But bus advocates refute that claim. They say that the eliminated bus lines didn't really duplicate rail lines because the rail lines make far fewer stops than buses.
Sometimes you need to go just 3 or 4 blocks, and the metro is more than 6 blocks, so they have to walk back about 3 or 4 more blocks, and there's people with disabilities that they can really walk a lot.
Now, the federal government is getting involved. The Federal Transit Administration, which oversees the nation's transit operations, held an on-site compliance review with the LA Bus Agency earlier this month to look into the matter. The Transit Administration is expected to publish their findings in the coming months. Leilani Albano, FSRN, Los Angeles.
And that's the program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.